Good afternoon. I'd like to open the House Interim Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Efficiency. We have no new members on this committee, so I think I'll forego the introductions. But we do need to adopt our committee rules at organizational meeting, so I will open the organizational meeting for that purpose. And Representative Lively, would you please make a motion?
Sure. Chair Hovey, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules as presented.
Representative Lively moves to adopt the proposed committee rules as presented. Committee, these are the same committee rules that you've seen in other committees if you've been attending your other committees. So any questions on the rules? Any discussion on the rules? Seeing no, is there any objection to the rules? Seeing none, the motion passes and the rules are adopted. And I think we're at a point where we're going to move on with an informational meeting. We have two subject matters at this informational meeting, and we're dealing with the review and best practices, or review of best practices and efficiencies for state boards and commissions. And we're also going to have an update from agencies around foreclosures in Oregon and an update on our foreclosure assistance programs. So with that, we're going to go ahead and open the informational meeting and start out with the topic of boards and commissions. And with that, we have on our agenda, we do have a presentation from Todd Haggerty from NCSL. We're going to try to get him on the phone, I hope. And Kendall Clausen, I think I saw her back there. She's here. And Holly Mercer. And so it will be an interesting little discussion around boards and commissions. You're always hoping they answer.
Mr. Haggerty? This is the Oregon House Interim Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Efficiency.
How are you doing today?
Doing well. We have your presentation up when you're ready.
So, Mr. Haggerty, this is Paul Holby. I'm the chair of the committee, and thank you so much for taking the time to present some information to us about efficiencies and boards and commissions. As I know there's been a lot of work on this across the nation, so I appreciate your input. And we have a committee and a relatively good number of people in the audience who must find some interest in this topic. So I appreciate that, and we are at your slide and look forward to listening to you. So go ahead when you're ready.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, let me first just thank you for this opportunity on behalf of myself and NCSL. I'd also like to mention that I am joined today with my colleague Brenda Erickson from NCSL's Legislative Management Program, and she is one of our resident experts on sunset and sunrise provisions, which I know I will touch on later in this presentation. And she is here as well, in case we Mr. Chair, you or any other members of the committee have some additional questions. So I'm going to take a quick overview here of the approach I'll be taking today. I know that there's been an audit report from the state of Oregon that has looked at some of the examples of how other states have looked to review boards and commissions. So I'm going to take a two-pronged approach here. Look at that aspect from sunrise and sunset and other types of methods, but also look at it as a concerted effort that a number of states have made in response to the Great Recession by taking a dedicated effort at looking at to consolidate, eliminate review boards and commissions to create greater efficiency in government. And so, as you mentioned, Mr. Chair, a number of states have sought to consolidate or eliminate boards recently. In many cases, this has been part of a broader effort to find government efficiencies, find government reorganization to, streamline, find savings in government. And so if we see this map here that's coming up on your screen right now, this just lists at least three-quarters of the states have formed committees, commissions, task forces to make recommendations to legislatures and to the executive on some of the methods that states can go about increasing efficiency in general. And so in many cases, and actually if you read a number of the recommendations and reports, the topic of boards and commissions is a very prominent one. So if we go to the next slide here, I'll kind of give a little bit of an overview. This is pretty basic here, but there are four primary methods for consolidating, reviewing, eliminating boards and commissions. One can be through direct legislative action. Another can be through executive order. You have executive branch reorganization. And then you have like the sunset review process. So I'm going to start first here by pulling a couple of examples through legislative action. And these examples that I'll be drawing from have come from recommendations from state government and reorganization efficiency commissions. So this first one that I would like to actually highlight is some of the themes that come out of these reports of why to eliminate, consolidate, reorganize boards and commissions. One, and the most prominent one, and you can see this when we get to the actual numbers of those commissions or committees, I mean those commissions or boards that are found eliminated, is that they're inactive. They haven't met in a long period of time. Another key theme is that they've met their goal. The goal was met, the end product is there, there was either a report or addressing some issue, and it was met. Another one was duplicative. They found that there was a redundancy across these boards and commissions, that they could be streamlined and brought together. And the final theme that you can kind of see out of these topics is that it was a deregulation of industries, ones that said they no longer need to have a board overseeing this industry. So jumping into the kind of state examples, the first one I'd like to highlight here comes from the state of New York. Now, the state of New York in 2010 formed the Spending and Government Efficiency Commission, which had both executive and legislative representation, and also private sector representation on this commission as well. Through the recommendations from this commission, they made the FY 2013, the fiscal year 2013 budget bill, eliminated a number of boards and commissions. As you can see here, the inactive boards were the ones that were most predominantly eliminated. There were a number of boards that were merged. These boards were found duplicative. And again, as I mentioned with some of the common themes here, one board was found to have completed its mission, so therefore it was no longer needed. So in New York, you kind of see this really drawing out here, these common themes that when looking at boards and commissions, there are a number of stakeholders, constituencies at hand, and or there's a justification for the continuation of these boards. So that's why you tend to see the higher numbers in those that are inactive. Now, if I go to the next example that I have here, this is from the state of Virginia. And again, this comes from executive reorganization that was formed by the governor. They're called the Governor's Commission on Government Reform and Restructuring. Now, the governor, through this process, and then eventually through House Bill 1291 in 2012, eliminated a number of boards and commissions. As you can see here, a little bit of a contrast to New York here, you saw a number that were consolidated rather than outright eliminated. They found that those functions could best be handled in another area. In some cases, it was just directly transferred to the agency, saying that there was no reason for a board or commission to exist when the agency could effectively handle this and still have a strong relationship with either the occupation, professional organization, or in health care services, health providing. So you did see, again, a number that were eliminated with 17 boards and commissions that were eliminated. And you have kind of the transfer of duties, straight transfer of duties in three instances. And then you have the deregulation of industry in two instances. Now, in case you're interested, those two industries that were deregulated were hair braiders and hair braiding schools and salons, and the mold remediators and mold inspectors. Those are the two industries that were deregulated. It's important to note that both the New York and Virginia commissions, when they made these recommendations for consolidating, eliminating, merging boards and commissions, that they said the goal of savings wasn't tremendous out of this action, but it did streamline government in the overall sense and allowed for, in many cases, businesses to conduct matters with the state more efficiently. So I thought it was just an interesting point to bring out there, coming from my primary background, which is fiscal research. You tend to look for a lot of savings in these areas, but they said that there really wasn't a lot there, but it gives the overall improvement to efficiency in government. Now, the next instance I want to go to here now is from the state of Nevada. So in 2011, the state of Nevada created a subcommittee of the legislative commission, and this commission, the Sunset Subcommittee Commission, was responsible for reviewing only boards and commissions that were not provided for in the Constitution or by executive order. Now this is a recent change, and this goes to a lot of another concern I'll discuss a little bit later. But the original legislation that created this subcommittee required that it review 20 boards and commissions every year. Legislation this year was passed that reduced that number to 10. That, you know, kind of goes on to a point I'll touch on here in a little bit, is just the amount of work in performing these reviews. And again, I think it's an important point to note here that boards and commissions are subject to review not less than once every 10 years. And this is the amount of work and cost that goes to the board or commission on having to perform these reviews. And also, it's an important note to say that when the subcommittee determines that they would want to review a board or commission, they have to include a cost estimate for what it's going to entail when they come to this point. So if we can look to since the Sunset Commission was created in 2011, Nevada only meets every other year. So they came up with their recommendations in 2012, just before the start of the general session in 2013. And their recommendations, which were ultimately enacted in the 2013 session, were that 19 of the entities that they reviewed were to continue. 7 continued with further recommendation. And 3 entities were eliminated. And just in case you're interested in what those entities that were eliminated are, was the Committee on Co-Occurring Disorders, the Nevada Commission on Sports, and the Nevada State Funeral Board, which actually was more of a transfer of functions to another agency. So there you have an example of a sunset subcommittee by the legislature directed wholly at boards and commissions. It's important to note that there many states have broader sunset commissions, such as Texas, Washington, Arizona, to name a few, that require periodic reviews of all state government entities, whether it's on a 7-year schedule, a 10-year schedule, even a 12-year schedule. And again, there's a whole range of requirements within there. And boards and commissions fall into those having to be reviewed by those sunset commissions. As I mentioned in the beginning, you know, another method of streamlining, creating efficiencies, reducing boards and commissions is through executive order. And again, this is bound by many times those commissions and committees that are created by executive order, so not ones that are necessarily created by the legislature. And so I just pulled out a few examples on this slide here of examples of executive order. And you can find that this year, in Illinois, Governor Quinn issued an executive order which eliminated 75 boards and commissions. If you were to look at that, that's quite a bit. If you look at that list of boards and commissions, and a vast majority of those were inactive. So you're kind of looking at probably about two-thirds of those were inactive boards or commissions. Missouri, in 2013, 13 boards and commissions were eliminated. The governor had originally proposed to eliminate 18, but only 13 of those in the end were eliminated. And then in Washington, a unique case, the governor issued an executive order eliminating 17 boards and commissions. What's important to know about Washington is required, started in 1977 and then modified in 1994, that the governor and the Office of Financial Management must review existing boards and commissions and submit this review to the legislature every odd number year, recommending which boards and commissions should be terminated or consolidated. And there are a number of key recommendations that the governor and the executive branch must consider when going down this. And I think that we'll hear a little bit later from the state auditor that has also looked into these questions. And it's important to note that if you look at other states as well when looking at sunsets of or reviews of boards and commissions, that other states such as Arizona has at least 12 factors for reviewing boards and commissions. Those are increased when you go to agencies. So it is fairly common that there is a prescribed set of standards or questions that must be answered when conducting these reviews. Now, lastly, I want to touch on just a couple of other types of review. So you don't necessarily fall into the post-review of already existing boards and commissions. In some cases, they sort of do. Now, Sunrise Review, which a number of states have, Colorado, Arizona again, Maine, Tennessee, Hawaii, they all have Sunrise Review provisions. And in many cases, these are directly for business and professional occupations. And there's a whole range of criteria of going from why does this industry or profession need to be regulated, what will the scope of the board and the commission do before they can even get to that instance. So that's looking at it beforehand. Another example that I thought I would highlight here is that, and it's being used in Georgia currently, is that they are employing a zero-based budgeting model. Zero-based budgeting model, and again, this can be some sort of a gray area between sunset review. Essentially, every agency needs to justify, and including boards and commissions from the ground up, their existence, funding. Again, there's a schedule. While every agency, board, commission has to prepare a zero-based budget, it's on a kind of a rotating schedule because of workload of who's actually reviewed in any one year. And the last piece here that I want to touch on, and this is something that's unique to the state of Arizona, and it's part of their program budgeting sunset review process. But what's interesting about this is that it's actually it's something that as I mentioned, that's fairly unique, and that's that they have a master list of state government programs. The master list of state government programs, which was started in 1997. Requires a compilation that's released biannually of every single state government entity within the state. And this, and not only does every one of these entities have to be compiled, is that they also have to list out their strategic plan, how they're measuring up against any program performance goals. The most recent report, which just came out, said that when this list first started in the 90s, as I mentioned, there were over 1,200 state government entities. In the most recent report, this had been consolidated down to 528. So this has been a tool that has allowed legislators to look and see, where is their duplication, redundancy? Are they meeting their intended goals? So, while it's not a straight tool for making those decisions to consolidate, merge, or eliminate a board or commission, is something that can be used to help make those decisions. So with that, I would like to open it up to any questions that you all may have. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for this opportunity again.
Thank you very much. So, committee, generate any questions for Mr. Haggerty?
I will, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you. Thank you for this presentation, Mr. Haggerty. And I wonder if you have budget savings as a result of these commissions having been eliminated or merged. Do you collect that kind of information?
I can definitely provide. Actually, there are a few fiscal notes and also in some of these budget reports. But as I mentioned, with the government, the state, the Spending and Government Efficiency Commission in New York, and also the Commission for Government Reform of Virginia, both mentioned in their recommendations to the legislature, was that while there really aren't a tremendous amount of savings in consolidating, eliminating, merging boards and commissions, but rather it does provide the opportunity to just streamline government, and also in many cases, especially for those with professional occupations, and in some instances, you know, streamline the interaction between the private sector and government.
This is Brenda Erickson with NCSL. Following up on Todd's comments, a lot of the agencies do not quantify actual savings in that way. It's sometimes a policy that they don't do that. They leave that information or determination up to the legislators. They don't feel that it is necessarily their role to sometimes generate those numbers. So it's a mixed policy or procedure as to whether they actually do some of the quantification. There are some states, I know, that if you look at the Texas Sunset Commission's annual report, they do try to do some quantification of the work that they have done. But in many of the other offices, I've asked this question specifically, and they say they do not do that quantification.
Thank you.
So, thank you. I'm wondering if either one of you, I know we had a lot of different, methods of addressing efficiencies. I'm curious whether in the consolidating function, I guess, or practice, whether there was any examples of identifying redundant functions within particular agencies so that those could be the function, or say it's an administrative function or an enforcement function or a licensing function, which we have an example of here in Oregon, and I know Washington does, that not necessarily eliminating the board or commission, but just trying to identify services or functions that can be shared or consolidated.
Sure, certainly, and that's, you know, it comes back to a lot of the work on the actual review by identifying, you know, all the boards, commissions, the services that are provided. I'll just pull one example from Missouri here, where Missouri had an advisory council on aging. Well, it was found that this could be eliminated because its duties could be incorporated into the State Board of Senior Services. So sometimes it's just by actually listing and identifying those, is that how states have come to realize or have seen that perhaps this is duplicated, this is redundant, and it could be best be rolled into one board or the other.
And I'll follow up on that. I know that in many cases, when I've heard of reports, that is one of the things that is often found when they are actually going through either the sunset process or some other type of program evaluation or performance review, is that those items do come up, and they will note them for the information of the legislature so that the legislature is notified that there are the redundancies. And oftentimes that, as Todd noted, that many times it is not an elimination of a commission or or board, but rather a modification of its functions. So in some cases, they're modified to do this consolidation.
Thank you. I guess that was kind of the information I was looking for. You know, it's easy to, figure out that you can eliminate an inactive board or commission, but getting to the consolidation of their functions or eliminating redundancies the best you can, I'm wondering whether you have compiled the different criteria or factors that states use in considering what they can do as far as consolidating those functions or activities.
Well, when you look at, I'll start first. And when you look at the when you have like a government reform task force or commission, that's looking at these. It's usually driven by some sort of guiding principles rather than, here's a prescribed set of standards. But I think when you look at what comes out of that is that it's more that thorough analysis and listing of finding, where are there areas of duplication. That's easier said than done, which is why it takes a tremendous amount of work and why sometimes these, the recommendations, usually take like a couple of years to come out of some of these committees or commissions, which we're actually just starting to see in 2012 and 2013 legislative sessions for many of these entities that were formed in 2009 and 2010.
And a lot of these statutes that establish either the sunset process or sunrise process or program evaluation process actually sometimes list the questions or criteria that are supposed to be looked at. And so, for example, we mentioned Arizona. In their statute themselves, they list the 12 questions and the additional questions that for other instances that the sunset or actually in that case the auditor's office has to look at, and they can include that. So we can provide examples of those questions if you need. We can literally pull them out of the statutes and provide them. One of the things that many of the entities have found that do the sunrise and sunset, especially in the sunset factors, is that early on in the process, you'll see much more elimination as your function has been around for several years. Then what you end up finding is more modification or consolidation. So the elimination usually, as they called it, the low-hanging fruit, usually comes first as you start some type of sunset or sunset process. As that process continues, what you will find out and find is that more often than not, you will have the modification or consolidation function taking place.
Yes, thank you. And I it was that, list that you mentioned, like in Arizona's case, that I was looking for of those questions that need to be asked in the process. It just for us trying to accumulate a list of potential questions that we may want to consider to add to an agenda like this if we choose to take this on. And it's interesting you say that the elimination was low-hanging fruit. It seems that would be in the eye of the beholder, perhaps. But I appreciate the idea that it's low-hanging fruit.
Again, that was, as we said, oftentimes it's the ones that are inactive. That would be, if they haven't met in many cases for some of the cases for decades, those were the ones that were considered to be low-hanging.
Okay.
Inactive anyway, so.
Yeah, thank you. I was sort of tongue-in-cheek. So questions from, I don't want to monopolize this, more questions from the committee? I thank you very much for sharing this with us, and I hope my committee administrator will be able to contact you and maybe get from you a list of some of those principles or questions that are used to identify what direction we would go and what factors need to be considered for sunsetting or sunrise. And so I appreciate all your help, and I hope you have a great day.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, well, thank you very much for this opportunity again. We will follow up and send over, pull out some of the criteria here within the sunrise, sunset. I'll also include some of the key factors that drove some of these, you know, the broader government efficiency reform reorganization task force committees, councils that were formed, so you can have an opportunity to review what kind of drove the decision-making process there as well. So again, thank you very much for the time.
No, thank you again. So up next, to follow that up, we're going to have the governor's office, Kendall Clausen, and might as well have Holly Mercer come up as well. Unless you have other people that are coming with you, you're welcome to bring them as well. Good afternoon and welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair Hovey. Thank you so much for having me, members of the committee. I'm excited to be here.
Well, thank you. I know that you were aware that we had an informational meeting last spring, seems like years ago, but from the Secretary of State's office, who did an audit on boards and commissions, which sort of keyed us up for this ongoing conversation. And certainly former governors have looked at this issue and had reset committees and recommendations that came out from them on where we could find efficiencies. And so I wanted to give you an opportunity to speak to us today.
Thank you. Well, thank you, Chair Hovey and members of the committee. I'm really happy to be here to just provide a little insight from the ground, I suppose. I think that this is a really important topic, largely from a systemic and structural level. That tends to be the place that I linger the most. I think we're very fortunate in Oregon to have a pretty amazing system of citizen governance where members of our constituency, our neighbors, our family, our friends are able to participate in some of the thinking and decision making that drives what the state of Oregon does. Currently, just to give you a little baseline, we have 312 boards and commissions. I loved seeing that slide where they were only having to wrangle with five or six decisions. But there are 312 boards and commissions. Approximately 50% of them require Senate confirmation. The others do not. So if we were looking at that in terms of bodies and people who are serving, it's approximately 2,800 people who are volunteering their time. And this can go anywhere from 10 hours to 20 hours a month that people are putting in to the state of Oregon in service. While we're fortunate to have such a great system that allows volunteerism to help drive the state, some of the challenges I think that we face are really about that overall structure and system, and I'm not certain if we have all of the building blocks that we need to make sure that that's always stabilized and really focused on the primary function, which is to protect the public. So there were two things that I thought that I would share with you just based on my experience over the last 2.5 years of managing all 312 of these boards. The two primary areas that I would encourage your thinking would be around the issue of training and also around statutory construction. So starting with training, I think it's important for you to know that due to budget cuts, we have no official training or orientation program for any member of a board or commission. So we go through our entire vetting process to find really amazing candidates to serve. We get them through the confirmation process, and then I like to joke with folks and say that once that happens, I will drop you off at the doorstep of the board that you are serving and then break up with you and move on to the next group of people that we're trying to get through the process. The concern would be just about our ability to have any overarching sense of their understanding of their roles, responsibilities, and expectations in service. So imagine if any one of us arrived at work with no sense of what our work responsibilities are. We know a general idea of what the company does, but we don't necessarily know what our boss's expectations are of us. Then you fall into the trap of randomness in terms of how people are oriented to their new roles. I did bring along with me, I've got a couple things, but I'll share with you if I... this is the only thing that we provide. So we don't offer any in-person orientations. We've gathered together what we're calling a board handbook. There's a checklist where we ask people to check off that they have read and that they understand everything that's in that handbook. It's what we like to call the How Not to Go to Jail as a volunteer of the state. It's everything around being a public official and our overall expectations of participation. The challenge with that is that we are going on good faith. We're assuming that just by checking off that list that people have actually read it, that they understand it. There's no real means of engaged discussion with the members once they have been appointed. We have to rely heavily on administrators who already have their hands full in managing the day-to-day operation of the board. What we have found is that the orientation, once it lands in the hands of the administrator, then becomes a little more broad-based. So some people have requirements that they have to adhere to based on state expectations or federal expectations. So we've heard that some of the boards will train people based on their national model. Some will just train simply on the expectations of board membership for that particular board. But there's no cross-cutting message that says, now that you're here serving the state of Oregon, this is what we expect from you. And we're looking at you eye to eye. And if there are questions or concerns, we're here to help walk you through that. The other piece that I wanted to bring to your attention for your thinking is just around statutory construction. The whole discussion of sunrise and sunset that we just heard in the last presentation I think is very relevant here. I am also going to, I know I'm being unorthodox in this, I'm supposed to hand this over, but I am also relying on the drama factory because the newly completed, it took us a year to complete our board book, and I will let you have that approximately 2-pound board book. Is every single one of our boards and commissions. Wow. And we literally had an intern working for a year to identify all of the boards, what do they do, how many people does the governor appoint, how many people do the legislature, how many come from the legislature, how often they meet, do they require Senate confirmation. None of this was in existence before our arrival. So we had no idea. And, you know, I don't want to be cute about this, but literally when we walked in the door, we were dealing with piles and piles and piles of paper. I would open file cabinets and carrier pigeons and parchment paper would come out. And the reality is we needed to boost our electronic capacity. So all of that is in electronic form. So you'll all be getting a copy of it. Welcome. Happy holidays. So as we look at the issue of sunrise and sunset, what a great place to start. Wow, I wonder if this is already in existence. Well, maybe we should go through our board book to determine whether that's there. The other issue is around accountability and that we don't have a consistent pathway to who's responsible when issues arrive. We also created sort of our own internal triage system, if you will, that identifies who gets the call when there's a problem. So that's definitely something that I would encourage some high-level thinking about. And then the issue of overlap and redundancy, which you can see when you've got a board book that is that big, it's very possible to be unaware. And I'll tell you, in 2.5 years, I think I've touched probably 98% of those. but it took 2.5 years to touch all of those boards, to have some type of contact. So I could imagine that when an issue arises that we need the citizens' great thinking on, it would be a natural move to say, let's put a group of people together to think about this or to address this. And so I think that it opens the door for that type of overlap and redundancy. And then finally, just around the issue of data collection, I do think that there's opportunity there. Nothing that we're using to hold people's feet unnecessarily to a fire, but to certainly say, if we're going to create a board or a commission or workforce or a work group or a task force, what are our expectations for the end of that? So how do we know we've met our outcomes? How do we know if there are things that we could look at to make ourselves more efficient or to approach the issue that created that task force or that commission in the first place? Maybe we might learn something from actually collecting data about the work that we're doing, and we don't currently have a process around that. So those are the primary things that I just wanted to offer up that I've seen that I think could be helpful for us to begin thinking about. And once again, I thank you for the opportunity, and I'm open for any questions.
Questions for Ms. Lawson? I really appreciate the book, I think.
I have a wheelbarrow out there if you need it.
We're getting it electronically, right?
And I really appreciate the electronic offer. But it sounds like you're looking at a lot of the same things we were looking at as far as have interest in not knowing the future of whether we need legislative action to accomplish certain pieces of this. I look forward to working with you personally to try to, you know, maybe fashion some sort of a agenda for the future on how we can best serve Oregon with boards and commissions.
Thank you, sir.
And their work. I really appreciate your willingness to help us on that, and the governor's office for certain, too, if that willingness stays there. Because it makes our job a little bit easier and makes it maybe a more efficient process at the end of the day to engage everybody. So I appreciate that, and I'm going to turn it over to the Oregon Health Licensing Agency and Holly Mercer to tell us a little bit about the experience maybe that you've had in consolidating the health licensing functions for the health people. And go ahead and introduce yourself. Thank you.
Chair Holvey, Vice Chair Lively, Vice Chair Richardson, members of the committee, my name is Holly Mercer. I'm the Interim Executive Director for the Health Licensing Agency. Our agency has a mission to protect the public, including all those consumers that rely on our information to show that we have professionals that are qualified. We have a $7.6 million budget. We manage 70,000 licenses, about 38,000 people that hold those licenses. And we have a total of, because we picked up a new board in this session, 84 board members that we work with. We have a staff of 35 FTE, all but 4 are represented by SEIU. If you look at page 2 of our presentation, it spells out the variety of boards that are within our agency, starting with athletic trainers, body art practitioners, board of cosmetology, as you can see, is the anchor board for this agency, denture technology, direct entry midwives, environmental health registration board, hearing aid council, licensed dietitians, respiratory therapists, and I knew I would not say. Let's call them polysoms. Anyway, sleep technicians, combined board, and then sex offender treatment board. We gained an additional board this session, the behavior analysis regulatory board. It will start with an interim board coming this November. It will deal with children, autism, spectrum disorder therapy. So just a wide array of boards and professions. We think it's also important for this committee to understand that when you have this wide array, you have a variety of volume. And the volume in our agency is around the cosmetology board. And many of the other boards that we have very low volume. And one of the challenges with this agency is to provide a budget that has a cost allocation model that is equitable in that we have direct cost, which is DOJ and investigations, and then we have indirect costs, which is more of the infrastructure of our policy people, of our licensing people, of our HR, for example. And so we are able to blend that and build that out as an indirect cost to those boards. It is, we believe, a very efficient way to handle this variety of boards. It is not to say that just because a board has a low volume of licensees, they do not take a great deal of resources. And I think Representative Kenny Geyer could attest to that as we went through this last session. And with her help and a variety of other legislators' help, we're able to get mandatory licensing for direct entry midwives, which is quite a feat. That board, however, is operating in the red. We have three boards operating in the red. And we are able to maintain those boards and maintain the work for them, the core services of licensing, regulation, and policy, because of our structure. And this is only a model. It may not be the only model, but it has worked for these boards. And one of the things that we've managed to do, I believe, is make sure that our board members and the professions have a practical and pragmatic expectation of what we are able to do. We may not be able to move rules as quickly as maybe some of the separated independent boards. We may not be able to attend as many national conferences. We may not be able to even participate at the national level, like some professions do expect of their boards. And it's very important for those boards. But with the model that we have and the boards that we have built that expectation in that we will not be participating in many of those things. And it's a matter of actually picking your battles. I find that as a daily part of my job, trying to align our mission, which is public safety, with the budget and the variety of boards that we have. If you look at page 4, part of the what I've learned about this agency is pieces that I didn't even know took place. We test every person that gets a cosmetology license at our office on Summer Street. And on a yearly basis, for all of our boards, we test about 7,700 people. And they come through, they come in, they give their information to our front staff, and in many instances are able to walk out with the license. One of the things that I did want to point out is that we who have been on the receiving end of maybe perhaps many consolidations are now, because of House Bill 2074, we are being moved over, transitioned in, consolidated into the health authority as of July 1st, 2014. Already, we have found some efficiencies with that. We have a position in fiscal that a lot of the health authority will pick up our fiscal piece. We are able to take that position and move it over to our investigation side. And wherever we have vacancies in our infrastructure, we will continue to look at those for the next, you know, several months and find out if we can have the health authority pick up some of our infrastructure and move our services back out to licensing investigations. That's what we'll try to do, because the core service of what we do is like many boards. It is licensing, enforcement, and policy. And we just need to keep the work moving through. And I think one of our very best practices for this agency is managing this diverse boards. We have 29 board meetings a year, and we meet, we get our documents in, we have a streamlined format. 2 weeks in advance, we do a dry run for every board meeting. We then have the board meeting, and then we do a to-do list that goes out to our board members afterwards, and then that holds our feet to the fire in terms of completing the work. When I, in my previous position at the Board of Nursing as Executive Director, same number, we had 70,000 licenses, closer to 50,000 nurses, 20,000 CNAs. We had 11 board meetings a year, and I very much felt like there would not be one extra day for another board meeting. So I was very curious how we would manage this many boards and this many board meetings. They're not as long. They're not as involved. Granted, they're different professions. Some of the other health professions take that time, and those professions demand more attention. For we have been able to build, I think, a culture among our boards to understand there's trade-offs. And to get this consolidated model, we have had to streamline some of the things that we do. And as long as we can keep our service levels at a point where we're moving the work through and we're trying to meet our deadlines, this works. This model is a great model. But any time, and I think there's a tipping point for consolidation, and I think that what I would ask the legislature to look at maintaining service levels. Whatever decision is made, I would hope that we would look at service levels to our consumers, to the practitioner, and to our board members to make sure that those don't drop in any way. The thing that we do not do well with our agency is we do not have a robust database. We have got to improve that over time. And I know it's a project, and I know it's expensive, but in order to gain greater efficiency, we've got to be run off data. We have to have data reports to our managers that tell us whether or not we're staying on task, whether or not we're getting those investigations done. What are the caseloads? What's the turnaround time on licensure for the variety of boards? And the one that we need to make happen as soon as we get settled into the health authority is we have got to be more transparent with our consumers. Right now, we do not attach discipline or civil penalties to our practitioners or our facilities. That has got to happen. We've got to have a consumer be able to go to any cosmetology facility, look it up, and see if there's been civil penalties for safety and sanitation. And that needs to happen. So we've got to take this next year to get settled into the health authority, but we've already started discussions with IT and with actually NIC USA, e-government, to see if there's some options there to make that happen very quickly. The other thing I would like to tell this committee is that I know that the Department of Justice takes a lot of flack for their, you know, expensive bills. We absolutely value our Department of Justice. We have a general counsel and lead trial counsel that has provided consistency and stability for this agency, and they are worth every penny that we pay them. And I think in the long run, they help us protect consumers. And I would hope that when we transfer to the health authority, we can retain that consistency that we've had with the Department of Justice. So that's all I have. It's a very, very fun agency to work with, and I know we are not perfect. We have a great deal of work to do, but we're open to it. I'm looking at Representative Kenny Geyer and this committee because you reviewed the natural hair care bill along with us, passed that bill, and we have already sent out the online tutorial to be looked at, beta tested by our stakeholders, free. It will be a 40-45 question certification. They print the certification. They send in their ID. They send in a $20 application fee and a $25 license fee for the first 2 years, and they are good to practice. So we tried to take your direction, keep it simple, make it administratively efficient. And we look forward to moving in. January 14 is when they will be certified.
Thank you.
That's all I have. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Great. Questions from the committee, Representative Lively.
So 12 citizen boards and 84 board members. And so are they all? Is there a uniform process how they get on each one, or does each one of those boards specifically have a process in which how they choose members, or how does that work?
So board members, they're either Senate confirmed or they are just, you know, they send in an interest form and the governor goes ahead and appoints them without Senate confirmation. But each of the boards, in terms of the professions, mm-hmm. have a variety of applications That's and right. pathways, we call them, to licensure. That part is fairly complex. But each of the board members has to be processed into the HR system. They each have to have travel reimbursements.
Sure.
And so there is a body of work around managing those board members. And then just the in and the out and the reappointments and the expirations. And so there is some resource around that.
But you manage. You're
group manages all of that.
That is correct, yes.
Representative Kenny Geyer.
You probably knew a question was coming here. Partly a question, partly an editorial comment. Holly, you've done an incredible job in a short amount of time as the interim director, and I think it's no secret that everyone knows I am very eager for you to get a permanent status there as director, because you've brought incredible stability and knowledge from your the nursing board that you oversaw. Part of that was the agreement you had worked out with DOJ, which I know from the midwives don't have that, and so their legal fees really go up and down. And so I think you in particular have brought a lot of expertise. And I think the model of having numerous smaller boards under one heading achieves those kind of economies of scale and expertise that are really needed for small boards. So I'm delighted by that. The hard question here is, as you're transferring from, you've been under DAS, mm-hmm. right?
Correct.
And it's going
yes.
over now to Oregon Health Authority, and you're finding these efficiencies now through the sharing fiscal, et cetera. How much of that has to do with your expertise, and it would have happened anyway under DAS, versus is it better that you're, aside from the obvious health factor, administratively, is it better that you're under Oregon Health Authority than DAS? Tricky question, but we're going to need to look at that in terms of what is the umbrella departmental organization for these different commissions. So it's a hardball question.
Chair Hovey, Representative Kenny Geyer. I think part of that is alignment, in that the health authority has a similar mission in terms of protecting the health of Oregonians. Mm-hmm. But there's going to be some cross-references. For example, there's licensure for birthing centers mm-hmm. and regulation of birthing centers, mm-hmm. The whole regulation around environmental health. We plan on leveraging those associations, and I'm hoping that we'll find even more. And I know that Dr. Goldberg has said that they'll be looking at our licensing end. What if we were able to get a database that worked for the health authority and our agency, that provided outcome data, that provided the data that we need for trending, for example? So we're anxious for that. I don't know. You have to be open and receptive to the benefit of change, and I do think that that's part of what our leadership needs to do. And so we're trying to keep our staff very positive about this change. We've invited the project manager, the interim director of HR from the health authority, and their budget director to our all-staff meeting next Monday. And explain what's going to happen on the union side, and just try to calm the fears of our staff. We also have to calm our fears of our board members to some degree. They want to make sure that their funds are kept separate, which they, by statute, will be. So we're anxious. There's, of course, apprehension. I would not be honest if I didn't say that. But we're trying to stay positive and see the benefit of that. And, Chair, if I could also say something about, it was interesting on the sunrise. I would ask that if we're going to have boards come in new, to really look at how they're budgeted, because as a receiving agency of those new boards, we try to write a very a fiscal that allows that legislation to happen without knowing exactly how many licensees or how much they're going to have in DOJ and investigations. And sometimes you do need to look at those after a few years and see how do we have proper funding here. And I'm very anxious to have more eyes on our cost allocation model. We want feedback about that, so that we're sure that we've hit the mark in terms of balancing those boards that truly are struggling with their budget. Thank you for that.
Other questions? Representative Richardson.
I've got a couple. I want, periodically, meaning like every time we're in session, there has been an attempt to fairly drastically raise the fees on some of the smaller boards, and we're always told that because they have to eat what you kill, you've got to pay your own way. Mm-hmm. Would you summarize how the structure you have now will help smaller boards have fees that are based on what what is being done there and not based on how many people they are and how much money you want to raise in order to regulate them.
Yes. Chair Holvey, Representative Richardson. I think the challenge there is we can put some ends of the spectrum together. The direct entry midwives per year, per midwife, pay $1,200 in licensing fees. That is many, many times more than a nurse pays, for example. And it's because high-risk, low-volume of licensees. If they were not in a consolidated model, I truly believe that it would be an emergent situation for them. I feel that what we're able to do on cosmetology, $45 for each field of practice, and there's four of them, every 2 years, keeping it very reasonable. We had the opportunity recently to look at whether or not we wanted to test our applicants off-site. It would have doubled their application fee to do that. Now, it's inconvenient coming to Salem, but if you look at the big picture, it is a cost savings. I think that if you can look at efficiencies among a variety of costs and expenditures, at least you could try to keep those fees down. I don't know any other way to do it.
Okay, can I continue then? Mm-hmm. The assumption is that every unit has to pay its own way.
Yes.
That is just an assumption. We could easily have an assumption that the state wants to regulate and that we're going to charge a fee that is reasonable based on, for instance, the income production. I mean, doctors pay a fraction of what nurse practitioners make, and they make a bit more money. Is there any discussion, or how would you feel about a change in the assumptions so that we fund the regulation, but we charge based on a reasonable fee, and you don't tie the fee in with the regulation because it has nothing to do with the capacity of people to pay?
You mean nothing?
Chair Holvey, yes. Chair Holvey and Representative Richardson, that is exactly the challenge, because if the policy decision is to create these boards that there is no way that they are self-sustaining, you've got to create a model that can take some of that infrastructure and provide some efficiencies within the infrastructure. And because otherwise you wouldn't have many of these smaller boards. There is just not enough volume to pay for one bad legal case. And you that happens. You can't always just prevent. Even, I mean, people bring legal actions, as you know.
Got it. So basically what I'm suggesting is that we may look at it with a different paradigm, more like group insurance. We've got 70,000 people. If they pay in fees that are, there's a range depending on what's being done and so forth, into a pool, then when there is a problem, you have enough money in the pool to deal with the problem. And in group insurance, that's how that works, is you spread it out. It's a whole insurance concept. And I just would hope that you might consider advocating for a change in the way we do this, so that as some groups go down, we don't double their fee because there's half as many people when they couldn't control the fact that it's gone down. Second thing I want to ask is, I noticed that, just as an example, on body piercing, it says for registration you need to complete 1,150 hours of training and education. So that's 1,150 hours of seat time, and then you pass an exam. Why would we not be more concerned about the qualifications, which would be pass exam, than requiring someone in body piercing to have to lose 6 months of their life, plus the cost of paying for that, so that they can merely qualify for having enough time sitting in a seat somewhere?
Chair Holvey, Representative Richardson, I think that each of these boards, when they look at the qualification criteria, have felt that that was important. Certainly the training that we have in cosmetology, they felt that those hours were important. We had this issue come up on natural hair care, for example. Do we want to streamline it? Do we want to make someone who wants to focus on natural hair care go through the full array of cosmetology education? And the policy decision was no. Now, I have to say that we're taking that module to our board at our October 14th meeting. We are carrying kind of that message and that module to that board. They were concerned about that as a board. So I think there is that balance of, you know, operational requirements from the practice standpoint, and then just the regulatory requirements and finding that balance. So in my view, all of these models could be looked at, and we need to keep reassessing. We are going to reassess what we're doing with tattoo artists, for example, at their board meeting in October. Did we hit the mark in terms of testing and qualifications? We need to continually look at that.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I just wanted to just kind of finish with this concept that regulation should not be expanded for the purpose of regulating. It's about what is the goal of it. And if the goal is to ensure that body-piercing people can pierce bodies in a nice way and be hygienic and so forth, then that should be the goal, is to ensure that, not just make life miserable for them by saying, you're really smart, but you got to sit for 1,150 hours, and you have a hard time in remedial, but you got to sit for 1,150 hours, when it's really ultimately the testing that makes a difference.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Can I have a follow-up question with this?
Certainly.
Because what it is, I mean, for example, with tattooing or hair or whatever, is that 1,100 hours what the school's program is? So in other words, if I'm going to go to tattoo school, it's X amount of hours and so on and so forth before the school considers I'm proficient in tattooing.
Chair Hovey and Representative Doherty, I'm actually more comfortable, and I can get the answer back to you about tattoos. On cosmetology, that is a curriculum that's developed through the Department of Education.
Mm-hmm.
So that, and we, in fact, meet with the career school department, and are, as we speak, we have an RFP on the street to evaluate our cosmetology test,
mm-hmm.
to make sure that it's connecting with a job task analysis, so that it's looked at the field as what is expected in the profession, and then does the test actually test those competencies.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I will definitely get back to you in terms of the tattoo side.
Well, actually, I know how long the course was. I was going to go to tattoo school.
Oh.
Yeah, when I retired.
Recently?
Couple of years ago.
Oh, that was a.
But I just didn't think I'd get a whole lot of business. Who'd want to come to, you know, mom to get your tattoo?
Mom, right there.
Really appreciate your input into this, and it sounds like you're way too busy for us to bug you, but we may, in fact, do that anyway.
Happy to.
Because it sounds like there's a lot of, and I'm sure you and Kendall have also talked, some of the issues she's talking about training our board members and, you know, potentially the risk and liability that our board members have out there without having the training sometimes can be addressed through the efficiencies that your particular licensing agency is providing to a vast number of boards.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's, you know, a real key for us to consider.
Could we have like 250 hours of seat time to make sure that they're really trained before they come?
If that's what it takes to protect protect the consumers and our budgets, maybe so. as he's taking me south here for a few seconds, I don't know if you have anything else to add. I appreciate you coming forward and giving us a little briefing on, you know, what's happening in your world. And it does sound like, you know, there's a lot of things we can learn from your experience as well, and your knowledge of where we're at in state government with boards and commissions, as Kendall has mentioned it. You know, now we have a book, and at least we can identify the boards and commissions, and next maybe we should identify their functions and their programs to start looking. You know, I think that's fascinating that there's a state that has a list of all the programs and functions to help them sift through the potential or the data to find potential efficiencies. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
And
thank
your
you
presentations.
Thank you very much.
We'll take that under advisement as committee members and maybe talk amongst ourselves as to what our next step may be, and certainly engage the governor's office as well.
Chair Hovey, thank you very much, and members of the committee, I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, committee, didn't mean to schedule an entire afternoon, but I did want to get an opportunity for the committee to hear from our agencies that are dealing with foreclosure, as we have been working on foreclosure issues for quite some time. And though we have passed Senate Bill 558 in this last session, there's a transition happening right now, and I'm certain there's not a tremendous amount of data that's really we can draw conclusions from, but certainly I did want to have an update on the foreclosure issues and how our programs seem to be getting organized and set up, and how they're able to handle the tasks that we've given them. So with that, I'm not sure if everybody wants to come up together or separately, or I've got Margaret Van Fleet, Janet Forth, and Emily Ryman. Good afternoon and welcome, and thank you for sitting through this gripping issue of boards and commissions.
Absolutely. Good afternoon, Chair Holvey and members of the committee. My name is Margaret Van Vliet. I'm the director of the Oregon Housing and Community Services Department, and I'm going to, with my colleagues here, give you a little bit of an overview of what's been happening in the foreclosure world in the last several months. I'll set up the context and then turn it over to Janet and Emily. And so we're going to see if we can make this PowerPoint work. I want to start by just giving you a quick snapshot of the current state of what we think of as sort of at-risk homeowners in Oregon. As you know, foreclosure activity really began to spike in 2008, and while there are certainly early signs of economic recovery, what we know is that lots of homeowners, some 28,000 in Oregon, continue to be sort of at risk, and we use as the measure for that if they're 90 days or more late in making mortgage payments. That's an key indicator of sort of vulnerability, and so you can see that the number, while it's abating slightly, is still pretty high compared to past numbers. And so for the next couple of slides in a few minutes, I'm going to spend time kind of reacquainting you with the variety of tools we have in Oregon to address the foreclosure issue. We have counseling, some of which has been in place for quite some time. We have funds from the federal government, U.S. Department of Treasury, as well as a multi-bank settlement that came to us a couple of years ago. And then, of course, the legislation that you passed in the last couple of sessions intending to address that. So I'm going to just take a couple of minutes and walk you through each of those tools, if you will. So in the counseling arena, this work actually has been in place for many years, and it really started as pre-purchase counseling for homeowners before they would buy their first home. And we had for several years a strong network of nonprofits in communities providing pre-purchase housing counseling to first-time home buyers. And then as the foreclosure crisis began to come into play, a variety of federal tools, and the one noted here, NFMC, it stands for National Foreclosure Mitigation Counseling. That's a federal stream of funds that came through my agency, and we sent the dollars out to these local nonprofits so that they could begin shifting their work towards foreclosure mitigation counseling to supplement the pre-purchase counseling. In cases where that government funds that work at the local level, of course, it's free to the consumers and set up to be confidential so folks can feel confident about that. And then in 2010, you'll recall that the state received an allocation of $220 million. This was hardest hit funds. It was actually part of the TARP funds out of U.S. Treasury, Troubled Assets Relief Program. Because Oregon was designated as a hardest hit state by measures of unemployment and our foreclosure statistics at the time, we qualified for this source of funds. It came again through my agency, And we've been working to get those dollars out the door to at-risk homeowners for the last few years. To date, we've spent a little over $100 million of that, but are very much on track to get it all out the door in the next couple of years. We've helped more than 8,000 homeowners across the state, and I'm glad to say that we've really helped folks in all 36 counties of Oregon. The federal requirement is that we need to have this money spent by 2017. Again, we'll have ours in the hands of homeowners before that. One of the things I'm proud of is that this program for us in Oregon, we're, again, one of 19 states. We're a national leader in the percentage of our funds that have gone out the door to help homeowners, and we really credit our strong partnership with our local nonprofit partners. They are the front door for a homeowner who's in distress, and we encourage folks to go through their front door to get, again, the good counseling, and then also be able to access these resources to help them pay their mortgage and stay on top of things. The other thing I'm proud of is that we've practiced, I think, really good transparency with this program. So we have really good up-to-the-minute reports on who we're helping, how many homeowners in which county, and that kind of thing, pretty accessible on our website. So if that's an area of interest for you, I would encourage you to take a look at that website, and I'd be happy to talk with any of you further about that. We had federal auditors in just last week, and I'm glad to tell you that we got a clean audit out of the federal auditors for that stream of funds. The next tool that came along was this multi-bank settlement, and this happened in 2012. This was a national issue. Actually, 49 state attorneys general and the federal government announced this settlement with the five largest national mortgage servicers. And this there were a couple of different components of this, and it got pretty confusing because there was a lot going on in that same time frame, 2011-2012. So the biggest chunk of the money from the settlement actually was nationally dictated by the terms of the settlement. And what the settlement said to those five big banks was, you need to provide your customers with mortgage relief, a refinance, a short sale, a modification of some kind. And so they did that. And in Oregon, it was a total of $466 million of that kind of bank money that went to homeowners here in Oregon. They didn't come through my agency or any other state agency. That was what the banks were required to do by the terms of the federal state settlement. The other thing that happened nationally was there was lump sum payments available to homeowners who had already lost their homes, and that's that $1.5 billion number. In Oregon, what we knew was that there were almost 20,000 homeowners who had their mortgage serviced by one of those five big banks, and they were eligible for a lump sum payment of about $1,500 because they'd already been foreclosed upon. And so we worked really hard with the Department of Justice and others to reach out to those homeowners, those former homeowners, to find them and to make sure they knew that if they would fill out a simple postcard, they could claim their $1,500 lump sum payment. We, again, were a national leader in that. We had good outreach, and so we had some 80% of the eligible homeowners take advantage of that. So that was a little infusion of cash, small consolation if you've already lost your home, but it was something, and so we worked hard to make sure folks got that.
Ms. Van Fleet, does Oregon have access to the $466 million as far as the information on what categories that money was spent in, whether it was loan modification, principal reduction, or sales, yeah, you know, principal reductions or whatever? Did they divide it up and give us feedback on how it was used and who it went to?
Chair Holvey, I believe that they did, and my agency didn't collect that. It's possible that the Department of Justice did, and you'll hear from Janet in a couple of minutes. So then continuing with the settlement, The final piece was that about $29 million came to the state virtually as sort of whatever state government wants to do with this money. That money went into our general fund. Mm-hmm. And some of it came to my agency, and some of it went to the Department of Justice. And you can see there kind of the amount that came in 2012 and 2013 and what we're projecting for next year. The money that came to us was largely to continue the strong counseling program. And again, we don't do the counseling directly. I don't have counselors on my payroll. We contract this money with the local nonprofits, and you're going to hear from one in a minute. And they do the counseling. But we use that money to beef up their network of counselors, to provide some training, to make sure that in every Oregon county there was counselors available. And so we worked in partnership with DOJ, actually with DCBS as well, and with the nonprofits to structure how should we best use that counseling resource. And I've got another slide that gives a little bit more about the way that my agency used these resources. So again, the biggest chunk went to counselors. We also got some resources to help with legal assistance. We contracted with Legal Aid Services of Oregon, and that was so that folks would have access to a lawyer in case their situation was a little bit more complicated than a counselor might be able to handle, and it really needed the assistance of a lawyer. And remember that this was all happening at the time when we were also changing the law and saying, banks, you have to mediate. So the system was a little confusing for consumers. We wanted them to go see a counselor, you know, and we did a lot of outreach to say, counselors are available in your community. Here's how you find one, and we used some of our outreach dollars to do that. But then we also knew that in some situations they might need the help of a lawyer. So that was available to lower-income homeowners.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
How many lawyers in your pro bono network?
I don't know the answer to that, Chair Holvey and Representative Kenny Geyer. Can I get back to you with that? Yeah, there's probably somebody here in the room who does know that. So I think before I turn over to Janet, I would just add a couple of things. We're learning as we go. The rules, I mean, the landscape is changing in real time. We're watching as carefully as we can. What we know is that in all cases, if we can get a homeowner who's worried about their ability to keep their house to a counselor, maybe they go to mediation. Maybe they can access one of my hardest hit programs. Maybe there's some other resolution. And so our kind of consistent message has been, if you feel like you're at risk, go see a counselor. And we've made it as easy as possible in multiple languages on our website to help guide people towards a counselor. But we know the system remains really confusing, especially with the law kind of continuing to change. So I think we plan to come back in November and give you a little bit more of a status update about how's that pipeline looking and how many people are going through the door, both for mediation and for counseling. So I think I'll pause there and turn it over to Janet from Department of Justice, and she'll give you a little bit more information from her perspective.
Welcome. And if you just identify yourself for the record.
Absolutely. Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Janet Borth. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Justice, and I have been working on Oregon's foreclosure avoidance program for about the last year and a half. Representative Kenny Geyer, Chair Holvey, members of the committee, to answer your question, I believe it's five or six attorneys who are fully dedicated to foreclosure issues for low-income Oregonians. I'm here today primarily to provide an update on Oregon's foreclosure avoidance program. To go back to where we're coming from, Senate Bill 1552 was passed in the 2012 session. It required mediation in non-judicial foreclosures. There's two types of foreclosure in the state, judicial and non-judicial. Judicial involves the filing of a lawsuit. Non-judicial involves, and I'm oversimplifying a little, but recording a series of documents with the county clerks. At the time that Senate Bill 1552 was passed, non-judicial foreclosure was the predominant foreclosure method. A legal decision came down right about the time that Senate Bill 1552 went into effect, called the NIDE decision, and it brought into question whether the larger lending entities using a system called MERS could meet the recording requirements of nonjudicial foreclosure. And so right around the time that Senate Bill 1552 went into effect, there was a shift away from nonjudicial foreclosure. So unfortunately, we didn't see a lot of participation in that mediation program.
Yeah, one quick question. Was that national? That shift happened nationally, not just in Oregon as a result of our law?
Representative Kenny Geyer, Chair Holby, members of the committee, that was a state-specific decision. Mm-hmm. Oregon's Trust Deed Act has a series of technical recording requirements, and so it's Oregon-specific. So we had the mediation program. It didn't get a lot of activity, but of the cases that went to mediation, we had really good results. Most homeowners and even beneficiaries who went through, most homeowners were very happy with the mediation process. Some beneficiaries were less happy and some were really pretty positive about it. Over half reached agreement in mediation. Several more reached agreement after mediation, and several actually reached agreement before mediation. Just the act of offering this process caused the homeowner and their lender to come together. One other thing we saw in the surveys, you'll be hearing from a housing counselor, Ms. Ryman, and we've heard about housing counselors, overwhelming feedback that housing counselors were very helpful to homeowners in that process, and also the nonprofit pro bono legal aid attorneys were very helpful. That was effective July 6, 2012 to August 4th, 2013.
So to reiterate what I think I just heard you say, that 1552, was dealing with nonjudicial foreclosures, and of those 25 cases that went to mediation, you reached agreement, people were happy, but there was also a lot of cases that, I guess, came to agreement or got settled without going to mediation.
Chair Holby, members of the committee, some of the cases I spoke about went through mediation. They weren't able to come to an agreement, but the mediation got them farther, and then in the weeks after the mediation, they were able to come to an agreement. And there were a few that I think resolved their issue before going to mediation.
Thanks.
This slide, again, shows the trend of foreclosures in Oregon, and we see that through 2006, it was hovering right around 5,000 per year. You can see it spike. Right around 2012, there's a general drop in overall foreclosures. A lot of that decreased activity happened in the later part of 2012. After 1552 and NIDE came down, there was just a general drop in activity, although that activity has generally started to pick up again, as you can see. And you can also see those yellow and blue lines, that pretty dramatic shift from nonjudicial to judicial foreclosure.
So can I don't know if you can comment, because this graph, though dramatic, isn't quite as dramatic as identifying the people that are in delinquent, over 90-day delinquent. That graph doesn't show a drop, really. It goes up, and it's kind of hovering high, so there's a little bit of discrepancy between the filings and the... Is it because there's a delay in the filings, because as we're shifting from judicial to non-judicial and the implementation of 558? I guess I'm asking you to guess.
Okay. Chair Holby, I'll guess, and Janet may have a different guess. I think it's that banks, because there was uncertainty in the market, mm-hmm. and what to do with the courts, my sense is they just held off on filing foreclosure actions against homeowners who were delinquent or otherwise in default. And so I think what we're going to see is, now that some of the confusion is out of the system, they'll clear their backlog, so to speak, is my prediction. But I don't know if you see that differently.
Chair Holby, members of the committee, I'm a little hesitant to speculate.
Just like an attorney.
There you go.
You can be hesitant.
You can. Thank you. and so we come to Senate Bill 558. And 558 did a few great things. It closed the judicial loophole. It simplified some of the notice requirements. It streamlined some of the document requirements. It did provide the Attorney General's office with enforcement authority. And to recap a little bit of what the program is now, before a lender, a large lender, there are smaller lenders are exempt and they can file an exemption, but before a larger lender can foreclose on a homeowner, they need to first let DOJ's contractor know, send that information in a payment to DOJ via our contractor, who sends a notice out to the homeowner saying, your lender's getting ready to foreclose on you. You have a chance to meet with them before that happens under Oregon law. And that happens up front. That's the majority of what we're going to see in this new program. There is a second way of going to a resolution conference with the lender, and that's where a homeowner proactively seeks out their lender. And to do that, the homeowner first must see a housing counselor and get a certification from a housing counselor that the homeowner might qualify for a foreclosure avoidance measure because of some financial hardship or because the homeowner is already delinquent. And that second piece is a little bit of a departure from 1552 in that there's a little more upfront work that needs to happen on the part of the homeowner. So in the early first 6 weeks of 558, that first larger category that I talked to, the lender requests, we've had more in 6 weeks than we had in 13 months under 1552. Under 1552, our state agencies were not exempt under the law, and so a lot of the requests we saw were actually from state agencies, which I don't think were necessarily all the lenders that we were hoping would participate in mediation. I have a note there that Chase and we and our contractor have been in pretty close contact with Chase and Wells Fargo, and to some extent with Bank of America. I found out today that Chase is part of the way through the process of referring another 621 cases into the program. We've heard from Wells Fargo that they are working on somewhere in the range of 1,500 cases that they're getting ready to send over in batches. And our contractor has been reaching out to Bank of America and generally has been going to different trustees and banks giving system demonstrations of the software that's used to interact with the program. So we thought that it would take a while to get up to these sorts of numbers. These are big institutions. We thought it would take a little longer to start to see these sorts of results. So we're very encouraged. This is a depiction. It doesn't show the Chase requests yet, but again, it shows that the top three requests are not state agencies. We have two of the large servicers, NationStar and GreenTree. U.S. Bank participated under the last program, and they again have been real proactive about participating in this program. The second category of requests that can lead to a resolution conference between a homeowner and a lender, this one has not taken off quite as quickly as the lender requests. We'll see that we had quite a few more homeowner requests under 1552. I think there's a few reasons that we haven't seen as many so far, and to some extent this is conjecture. There are a few more steps that the homeowner needs to take under 558 versus 1552, so that might slow down the requests a little bit. We also, as a department, have been meeting with our stakeholders about outreach and how to maximize people who can benefit from the program using the program. And that outreach committee has taken a pretty broad view. At the time that we were putting this together, we went so far as to hold a focus group to figure out what envelopes what does the envelope look like that will make people more likely to open their mail, and how can we differentiate this program from the scams that people are seeing, quite frankly. And so we're continuing to meet. We're continuing to work on this. We're partnering with OHCS on outreach, and we'll keep monitoring that. The final aspect of the program that I'd like to update you on, we talked a bit during the session about what a proper exemption number is. So the goal was that smaller lenders probably shouldn't have to participate with this program. And what we're seeing is that most of the exempt lenders are not doing very many foreclosures at all. We weren't really sure what's the right number. There was a lot of discussion around that. And what we've seen so far will be DOJ will keep receiving exemptions, is that most really aren't doing very many. So,
if I could make a comment to the DOJ, dealing with constituents on these foreclosures, the help that you guys gave was absolutely fantastic. I could get nothing through the banks. I could get nothing through this. One phone call, and the gentleman that was working with this really did help the constituents, and so I just thank you very much. DOJ did a great job.
Thank you, Representative Dougherty.
So on that pie chart, are you keeping track of who are those beneficiaries that are filing to be exempt, maybe not so much in the 0 to 9 category because they're so small and seem to be the large portion of it, so it's not really a huge issue, but I'm just curious whether you track who they are, who's filing exemptions.
Chair Hovey, members of the committee, we do. I have a list sorted by exemptions with me, actually, and we have every exemption that's been filed posted on DOJ's website as well.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like, you know, the bulk of the exemptions are very small, so, you know, it looks like I guess it's too early to draw any conclusions from all of that, but and maybe we'll go ahead and let Emily testify before we get too sidetracked with a lot more questions.
Sure. Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Emily Ryman, and I oversee the foreclosure counseling programs at NEDCO, which is the counseling agency that serves Lane, Marion, and Clackamas counties. I've also been involved in the Attorney General's advisory group that was involved in implementing both 1552 and 558, so I've been able to represent counseling agencies in that process. I'm here to talk with you a little bit today just about the trends that we're seeing on the ground at counseling agencies and the work that we've been doing with clients most recently. Just to start with a couple of the broad overview trends from 2013, obviously we had to do a little bit of adjusting to that shift from non-judicial to judicial foreclosures. Looking back at this point, I actually think that we as counseling agencies might have over-anticipated how much shifting we would have to do. We got a little bit nervous about what that would mean for consumers trying to navigate the process and for us trying to help consumers. Mm-hmm. And in the end, it really actually didn't mean very broad changes for us as counseling agencies. We obviously did a little bit of retraining of our counselors to get them more information about the judicial foreclosure process, primarily so that they would not step over that line of trying to provide legal advice when we are not attorneys. So we know much more about that process now and are able to help clients navigate it. We also adjusted our outreach methods a little bit to try to reach people earlier in the process so that as soon as possible after they had a judicial foreclosure filed, we were reaching out to them and trying to help them understand what their next steps could be moving forward. And then we also have been working very closely with attorney partners around the state, both through the legal aid program and with private attorneys in our communities who work in this area, so that we have a strong referral network when we recognize that we can't provide the extent of help that homeowners need in that situation. And at the end of the day, we now really have a system where we as counseling agencies can work, I think, equally effectively with clients, whether they're facing a non-judicial or a judicial foreclosure. And much of the work that we do with them remains unchanged. We're seeing that timelines have not been impacted very much. We're seeing clients still reach roughly the same resolutions that they were able to before. We're still able to help them get modifications through even once that judicial process has started. So I think at the end of the day, it actually hasn't changed our process or our system as much as we thought that it might. One of the second trends that we're seeing is an increase in servicing transfers. So it's increasingly common for clients to come into us and their loan is serviced by a particular lender or servicer. We help them start a modification application or a forbearance application, and somewhere during that time, either the loan or the servicing rights are sold. And that adds kind of a complicating twist to that process. It oftentimes means that clients are having to redo paperwork or restart timelines, even when they shouldn't necessarily, according to guidelines. We're finding in practice that that actually does set them back quite a bit in our seeking to get them a resolution. We're hoping that that's something that the resolution conference program might help us streamline a little bit, but we have yet to see that. And finally, we got our first experience with the mediation program. Even though there were only 25 statewide, 10 of those happened to be with NEDCO clients. Obviously, 10 is not enough to really draw sweeping conclusions. But from the 10 who we worked with, 5 were able to reach a resolution right at the conference, and an additional 2 were able to reach resolution in the weeks following the conference because of the conversation that was started there. So, you know, it's a great resolution rate, I think, in the beginning of the program. And we're actually particularly excited about it because, given some of the quirks of 1552, many of those loans were not with traditional lenders. They were Oregon bond loans or other loans that have some unique characteristics to them that actually make it a little bit harder to reach a resolution. So I think it's pretty encouraging that 70% of the clients we worked with, even with those slightly more difficult loans, were able to get to a resolution. And I would just echo Ms. Borth's comments that we received resoundingly positive feedback from the clients who went through the process. Even those who didn't reach a resolution felt like they were heard, felt like they had a chance to talk with their lender, and were really positive about that experience. We're also very excited and hopeful about the shift to 558. I would echo the comments that we expected it to take a little longer for the beneficiaries to begin filing, and we already have more clients in our pipeline under 558 than we had in the entire year under 1552. So we're already seeing those numbers tick up in the referral to us as a counseling agency. This is a graph that just shows our sort of demand trends over the last year. The three lines that you see, the yellow line shows inquiries, which are simply calls that we get from the public. This is a good way for us to track the potential clients coming in the next couple months to us as these begin to utilize our services. A lot of these inquiries actually won't ever become clients, though. We found that we can offer the sort of public service of a 15 or 20 minute phone conversation with a lot of clients who might need a referral to an attorney or a referral to learn more about their refinance options if they're underwater, where they don't necessarily need full counseling, but they need somebody who can provide a little bit of guidance. The blue line is attendees at our workshops, and the pink-red line is clients who have come in to become full counseling clients. So you can see an obvious trend. Over the first half of the year, our numbers were pretty steady in all three categories, and since June and July, we've seen a very interesting and marked uptick in the demand for those services. So these are obviously numbers that we're watching very carefully. The thing I find most intriguing about them is that this happened before we started seeing clients referred from the Resolution Conference program. So this was just, I think, a combination of a couple of things. The graph that you looked at earlier where you could see the decrease in foreclosure filings in 2012 and then beginning to uptick again in 2013, I think we're starting to see some of the response from that. I also think that we're seeing the effectiveness of a lot of the outreach that happened last year. The truth is that until a year ago when we received additional resources from the legislature through OHCS, we really didn't, our agencies didn't have the capacity to do much outreach, nor did we have the staff to serve additional clients if they were able to find their way to us. So last year we were in the unique position of finally having capacity to serve more people and finally having the resources through OHCS to be able to do some really effective statewide marketing. So as Director Van Gleet mentioned earlier, a lot of that marketing in the absence of an early functioning mediation program was geared at encouraging homeowners to make use of counseling. And I think we're seeing the positive impacts of that outreach in these numbers. I think I'm also, this also makes me hopeful for, I think, the outreach that can happen around directing clients to the mediation program for those who may be able to opt in. And we are working very carefully with DOJ and OHCS to help those initiatives. And I think that we can really make that 8 number that you saw earlier for the grant-initiated cases increase rapidly and have much better numbers here shortly if we're able to invest the same time and energy and resources in outreach for that campaign. Another question that I get often looking at these numbers from my staff and from other counseling agencies is what happens if we suddenly get inundated, if we just get buried because the beneficiaries begin to send over 600 cases at a time. And that's obviously something we're watching closely. I think we as counseling agencies have worked over the last year to put really flexible systems in place so that we can try to accommodate whatever the demand is that comes to us. And what I come back to at the end of the day also is, if that's the problem that we face, if the problem we face is this program is helping so many people and we as counselors are able to see so many people that we just don't know how to handle it, that will be a problem that I'm happy to face and happy to have the conversations about what resources we can put in place to be able to meet with every homeowner and to meet that demand successfully. And finally, I just want to show a little bit of a snapshot in terms of the outcomes that we're seeing from counseling clients right now. This is the 109 counseling clients that began working with NEDCO in the first quarter of this year, so between January and March of this year. And just to highlight a couple of points from this graph, only one of those homeowners actually had their home foreclosed, so I think that's a pretty positive story of the impacts that counseling can have. About a quarter of the clients showed as referred to legal assistance or referred to other. That other category is predominantly the hardest hit funds programs, if we recognize that clients might be eligible for that service, or possibly also to short sale realtors, who we work very closely with as well. And I think those numbers echo what Director Van Vliet said earlier, which is that we in Oregon have a very high-functioning system of resources and tools to use on behalf of clients. We work very closely together, and the counseling agencies really can act as a hub to try to get clients to the resources that most meet the needs that they have. And lastly, obviously, more than a third of the cases we began working with in January are still active and still pending some kind of resolution. In large part, those are clients who have pending modification applications in, and they're still struggling with finally getting to a complete paperwork stage, finally getting an answer from the beneficiaries. And this is a number that we're very interested in keeping an eye on over the next year, because it's our hope that with the resolution conference system in place, that this number will decrease significantly. And that we'll be able to start helping clients reach a resolution faster because of the timelines involved in the resolution conference system, and that 6 months after we begin working with clients, a much higher percentage of them actually have a final resolution. I think I'll end it there and open for questions.
Thank you. I appreciate the presentation. It was very, very good. I am happy to see that the infrastructure is, you know, in place. I guess, you know, my fear is maybe like other people's that you seem to welcome, is the capacity issue when you're talking about, you know, some of the larger beneficiaries getting ready to, you know, do a lot of filings and, you know, whether the capacity is going to be there to also provide the legal assistance, because I understand there's five funded attorneys, I think, through the law center, but I believe they have over 30 pro bono from conversations. I have to answer your question. We'll get some of that at maybe a subsequent meeting when we hear from the industry and some of the law center folks on this issue. I mean, this was primarily to kind of look at, gee, where are we set up? Well, how's our infrastructure going? That sort of meeting. So it looks like it's going well from me. I do, you know, commend the infrastructure that you've got set up. It looks like it's head the right direction. The outreach is certainly important. I'm curious on the outreach whether you're also hitting not just the consumers that are facing foreclosure that are have filings filed against them, but whether you're also able to make contact with those that are in the 90-day delinquency arena that you're also documenting, because it seems like contacting them would make that number 8 go up quite a bit, because once foreclosure is filed, I assume that the beneficiary is the one that's initiating the request for counseling. And
yeah. So Chair Holvey, I'll try and address that. You know, I think it's we haven't done specific targeted sort of mailings, for example, to those kind of subpopulations. We're trying to make sure that there's a robust set of tools online, and that doesn't work for everybody, but it does work for a good share of Oregon homeowners. And then sort of calibrate what else based on what the local partners are seeing. You know, sometimes that's, you know, bulletin board in the church basement or at the Safeway store, and sometimes that's a fair where people come and learn about what resources are available. So I think it's really a combination of a state blanketing kind of approach and a locally tailored approach. And so I think we want to keep an eye on it. You know, we've done a lot that I think was really effective, and we need to sort of keep an eye on who are we missing. And if there's a way to sort of capture that going forward, we'll certainly try and do that.
So a question about the counseling, you know, looking at the capacity, and it looks like you're well poised to take on those 600 filings at one time. Do you have any feedback from the Legal Assistance Network about their capacity to meet the demand for the people that you're referring out? Do you have any follow-up with, are there people falling through the cracks on that? Or, you know, and then I'm going to get to the, you know, funds question. You know, how do we, you know, do you have access to funds to accommodate the capacity issues that may come?
Sure. Chair Holvey, members of the committee, I don't know a great detail about the legal assistance program, so I don't want to say anything that I don't know for sure. But I do know that they are very busy and that they have been helping a lot of clients who are facing judicial foreclosures before we even got to a place where they could begin attending resolution conference with those same homeowners. So they're busy. They're definitely trying to build the pro bono network. And we as counseling agencies are trying to build our own network of private attorneys locally to be able to meet that demand. But it is great, and the legal assistance that they provide is something that counseling agencies just can't do, and it's a crucial piece of the puzzle for the services that are available.
And Chair Holvey, as to the budget, the amount we had appropriated to our agency to carry out these activities was reduced substantially, and I think the commitment on my part and on the members' part was that let's see how it goes and be reporting back to this body in the fall. And so I think it's a little early for us to feel like we can give you a good accounting, but I think in November we should be able to do that, and then I think let policymakers sort of think about do we want to invest more in that to keep the robust system in place. So we'll be prepared in 60 days to come back with the best data that we can.
And the reason I mention that, because I see that, you know, right, the uptick in potential filings, right, and, you know, the outreach to the people in distress seems critical, and the outreach to the consumer seems critical, and, you know, that takes funds, and I don't know where you're at with your funding. And okay, noticing, yes, that I'm not sure the legislature actually took part of that $29 million and set it aside for later use for your program. I guess I could ask that question and find out, but I'm not sure I'd like the answer. But anyway, I'm very happy. Other questions? Representative Kenny Geyer.
Okay, thanks. Well, this was a question around outreach. Thank you very much for all you've done, and to see a result of one foreclosure out of 109 is really amazing. If you don't have this information now, then it would be great to hear in November. You had mentioned having things in Spanish language, and I noticed that your website, NEDCO, and Legal Aid Society, none of them on the homepage have anything in Spanish about, you know, and I'm sure you have other outreach strategies. I know you work with Hacienda, CDC. I went to one of their workshops. I'm curious about what those outreach efforts are, how successful they are, and out of the people, you know, how many people who are second language learners, non-native English speakers, are in foreclosure, and, you know, what percentage of the population is that, and what percentage of the population that you're reaching through this program are also non-native speakers? That would help us figure out, are we reaching those people effectively through whatever outreach strategies you have?
Be happy to follow up. Thank you.
Thank you.
Sam Lively.
So thank you very much. First, just good work. I mean, a lot has changed from where this whole thing started, and I think we're fortunate in the state to have the team that's helping to serve the citizens. So I have a question, Emily, about this increasing servicing transfers. Doesn't that, if that happens, if they transfer the mortgage, doesn't that mean you just start over?
Not necessarily. Chair Holvey, members of the committee, it depends. There are various regulations depending on which guidelines which servicer has to follow. So, for example, there are guidelines in the National Mortgage Settlement. If the originating servicer that is transferring the loan is one of those five institutions, then there are certain guidelines that impact that. So the answer to that is it's complicated. And theoretically, the transferring servicer should be transferring the application, or a trial modification that is in process should be transferred, but that doesn't always happen as easily in practice as it should on paper. So sometimes it happens successfully, and sometimes it does get to a point where the homeowner just decides to start over because they're tired of being told, oh, it'll be transferred next month, it'll be transferred next month.
But if it's transferred, they do get to start over. I mean, it doesn't somehow use their time up, so the new provider or the new new servicer doesn't have some advantage over the previous servicer from the standpoint of the timeline in which they're eligible to do the mediation and that?
You know, I haven't seen this work out in practice in a resolution conference yet, so I would have to say I'm not sure what the implications
Great
of that
question.
Will be.
Good question.
I really appreciate you giving us an update, seeing where the agencies are, you know, as we move forward to try to make sure this program's successful. It looks like you're well poised to make sure that happens. I really do appreciate the work, and I'm amazed you have any data at this point, you know, since 558 just, you know, went into effect in August. So it was more information than I was expecting, so thank you very much for that. And I'm sure that we'll keep abreast of this, and, you know, once this, you know, once you get a little more data and things, we'll probably also have some information from the industry at a future meeting, whether that be November, January, February. I'm not really sure yet from this committee standpoint. Maybe some other committee will take faster interest, but I appreciate all the effort you've done, and appreciate the advocates and the attorneys that you work with, and all the people involved in this. It really is a big issue, as we see the high number of people that are in distress. Doesn't look like we're out of the woods on this at all. So it'll be interesting to hear feedback from the industry as well in the future. So thank you so much, and have a great afternoon.
Thank you.
Next on our agenda is adjourning.
Oh, no.
You need a motion?
No.
That's right, you need a motion.
I appreciate the attendance today, and hope you found some of this information at least interesting. A little bit about looking into the future on our government efficiency, and a little bit of check-in with what we've done in the consumer protection world as well. So with that, I will adjourn the House Interim Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Efficiency. Government Efficiency.